The Mortification of Sin by John Owen. Chapter 6. What is mortification? Mortification is a habitual weakening of sin. Every sinful desire is a depraved habit or disposition, continually inclining the heart toward evil. This is how the Bible describes a man who has not truly killed any sinful desire. Every imagination of the thoughts of his heart is only evil continually, Genesis 6 verse 5. He is always powerfully inclined or bent towards sin. And the only reason he does not continually pursue one particular sinful desire day and night is because he has many to serve, each one crying out to be satisfied. So he is distracted by various desires, but is nevertheless generally inclined towards self-satisfaction. So then, we will consider the sinful desire that we wish to kill to be a strong, deeply rooted habit. It powerfully bends the will and affections toward acting out that sin. This is what it means that men have their hearts set to do evil. Their spirit is inclined toward evil to make provision for the flesh, Romans 13, verse 14. Sinful depraved habits are distinguished from moral good habits. Whereas good habits gently incline the soul toward engaging in them, sinful habits violently urge or compel the soul forward. This is why Peter warns that sinful desires wage war against the soul, 1 Peter 2, verse 11. They rebel and fight against the believer's desires to do what is right with all the opposition and violence typical of acts of war, Romans 7, verse 23. The soul captive when they succeed in battle. These are all violent, vehement actions. From the description we have of it in Romans 7, I can demonstrate fully its tendency to blind the conscience, make the heart unresponsive to convictions, ignore reason, interrupt the power and influence of any thoughts that might hold it back, and break through all resistance into a flame. But that is not my present purpose. The first aspect of truly killing sin is weakening the habit of sin, so that it cannot rise up, agitate, provoke, or entice with the same violence, intensity, or frequency as it naturally is able to do, James 1, verses 14 and 15. One caution I would urge readers to remember is that every sinful desire by nature equally and universally inclines one to sin, with these two caveats. First, one sinful desire may be stronger or more powerful than another sinful desire. Likewise, the same sinful desire may be stronger in one man than in another man. Sometimes one sinful desire hits a man harder than another man, or harder than a different sinful desire does. Due to natural tendencies in him, frequent opportunities to be tempted, or simply because Satan has a grip on the man with which to manipulate him. When this happens, even though he still knows the truth, the sinful desire darkens his mind as with a mist, and his corrupt affections and passions are thus set free to wreak havoc. But more so, sinful desire gets strength from temptation. When the right temptation is combined with a sinful desire, it gives a new life, vigor, power, violence, and rage, which it did not seem to have before. Number two, some sinful desires are easier to detect than others. Paul describes the difference between sexual sin and all other sins. Flee sexual immorality. Every other sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 18. It means the activities of that sin are easier to feel and see than others. For example, the love of the world or the like might be just as habitual and widespread in the same person, yet it does not have the same destructive consequences. And because of this reality, some men may see themselves and even be seen in the eyes of the world as men who have killed their sin. Yet these men are just as filled with sinful desires as others who are astonished and troubled by the reality of their sins, or even those who have been hurried by the power of their sinful desires into scandalous sins. These men simply have sinful desires that are in and about things that do not bother them in their souls. They do not get worked up about them because they are more concerned with other things. Therefore, the first thing in mortification is the weakening of this habit, so that it will not compel and upset the soul that it has done so far. It must be weakened so that it will not entice and draw you aside. It must be weakened so that it will not be able to disrupt your efforts to strangle its life, strength, and determination to tempt you. This is called crucifying the flesh with its passions and desires. Galatians 5:24. That is, taking away the lifeblood and morale of the flesh to give it strength and power. The wasting away of the body of death, day by day. 2 Corinthians 4:16. When a man commits to this, his flesh is like a man nailed to the cross. It first struggles and strives and cries out with great strength and might. But as its lifeblood and will wastes away, its strivings become faint and infrequent. It moans, becomes quiet and hoarse, hardly making any noise. When a man first determines to deal with a sinful desire, it struggles violently to break free. It screams earnestly and impatiently to be satisfied and relieved. But when through mortification its blood and will are drained, it moves infrequently and faintly, cries sparingly, and grows barely audible to the heart. It might occasionally have a dying surge that puts on a show appearing to display great power and strength, but it is quickly over, especially if it is kept from succeeding. This is what the Apostle Paul describes in Romans 6:6. Here he says, sin is crucified. It is nailed to the cross. To what end? That the body of death may be brought to nothing. The power of sin weakened, bit by bit, so that we should no longer be enslaved to sin. That is, in order that sin might not incline and compel us to effectively make us slaves to it, as it has done up until now. Paul is not only speaking of physical pleasures or the desires of worldly things. No, he is saying that the whole flesh, the mind, and will that oppose God by nature must be weakened and killed. Whatever the root or nature of the sin is, however it might reveal itself, either by encouraging evil or hindering from good, the rule is the same. Sin must be starved and weakened. Unless this is done effectively, any other fighting or striving against sin will not work. A man may beat down the bitter fruit of an evil tree until he is tired. But while the root is still alive, beating down the present fruit will not keep it from producing more. This is a mistake some men make. They set themselves earnestly and diligently against a visible eruption of sinful desire. But since they leave the root of it untouched, and perhaps not even understood, they make little or no progress toward killing their sin. Mortification is our constant fighting against sin. It is a step of solid progress in mortification to always be putting pressure on sin. When sin is strong and lively, the soul is hardly able to gain any ground against it. The soul sighs and groans and mourns and is troubled. But it rarely has sin on the run. David complains that the sin had overtaken him so that he cannot see, Psalm 40:12. How little was he able to fight against it. Now, several things are necessary for fighting against sin. 1, recognize, notice, and regard sin as an enemy that must be destroyed. You must recognize that sin is an enemy that must be dealt with. Learn to take notice of it and regard it as an enemy indeed, and one that must be destroyed by all possible means. As I said before, this fight is taxing and hazardous. It is about the things of eternity. Therefore, when men take their sin lightly, one cannot conclude that they are making progress in killing sin. Every man must know the plague of his own heart, 1 Kings 8:38. Or no other work can be done in him. It is frightening that many men have so little knowledge of the main enemy that they carry around with them in their hearts. This makes them eager to justify themselves and to resist correction or warning regarding their sin, because they do not believe they are in any danger, 2 Chronicles 16, verse 10. Number 2, know how sin usually wins. To begin this fight, you must work to be familiar with the ways, tricks, methods, advantages, and opportunities that grant sin success. This is how men deal with their enemies. They learn how they think, figure out their objectives, and consider how they have won in the past so that they can stop them. This requires great skill. Take this away and I'll wage in a war through which we have gained the most in human wisdom and zeal would be mindless. Likewise, this is how those who kill their sin deal with their sinful desires. And they do not so only when sin is actually troubling, enticing, and seducing, but when they are at rest, they consider, this is our enemy. This is how he works in the direction he is going. These are his advantages. This is how he has won before, and this is what he would do if we do not stop him. Likewise, David considered, my sin is ever before me, Psalm 51, verse 3. And indeed, one of the most important aspects of useful spiritual wisdom is in discovering the subtleties, policies, and depths of any indwelling sin. We want to consider and know what its greatest strength is. What advantage does it use to capitalize on certain occasions, opportunities, and temptations? What pleas, pretenses, and excuses does it make? What strategies and embellishments does it make in order to hide the truth from me? Such wisdom helps us to set the wisdom of the Spirit against the craft of the old man, to trace a serpent in all of its turnings and windings, to be able to say at its most secret and imperceptible actings, this is your old way in course. I know what you aim at. Kind of readiness is a good part of our warfare. Number 3, use every weapon at your disposal. As the most important aspect of the battle, you must attack your sin daily with all the things at your disposal for killing and destroying it. One who fights this way never thinks a sinful desire is dead because it is quiet, but continues to work to give it new wounds, striking at it every day, Colossians 3, verse 5. Now, while the soul is at work in this condition and dealing with sin in this way, it has the upper hand, and sin is dying under the sword. Mortification consists in frequent success. Frequent success against any sin is another part and evidence of mortification. By success, I do not mean merely refraining from doing it so that it does not win when temptation comes, but victory over it and pursuit of it until it is completely conquered. For example, whenever your heart detects sin at work, seducing you, forming fantasies about how good it would be so that you feel inclined to make provisions for the flesh to fulfill its desires, the heart instantly seizes sin and brings it to the law of God and love of Christ, condemns it, and fully executes it. It is a good sign when a man begins to treat a sin like this, so that sinful desire is weakened in the root and foundation, and its movement and actions are fewer and weaker than they were before, so that they are not able to keep him from his duty or interrupt his peace. When he can quietly and calmly identify and fight against sin and have success against it, then sin is considerably slain, and despite its remaining opposition, the man may have peace with God all his days. The two approaches, then, will work for any troubling compulsion that puts on display the general depravity and corruption of our nature. First, you must weaken that sin's indwelling foothold in you that inclines, entices, and compels you to evil. And it rebels, opposes, and fights against God by adopting grace in the heart that stands in opposition to sin, and destructive of sin, giving it a home and habitual residence there. So pride is weakened by the implanting and growth of humility and passion is weakened by patience, uncleanness by purity of mind and conscience, love of this world by heavenly mindedness. The Holy Spirit acts with various forms of grace, just like our old natural corruption acts with various forms of sinful desire. Second, we must promptly, eagerly, cheerfully fight against sin and the power of the Spirit and new nature, using all the ways, means, and aids described here. Success largely depends on these two things. Through these efforts, if the sin does not have some unconquerable advantage because the man is naturally bent toward that desire, he may possibly gain so much of a conquest over it that his soul may never again feel opposition from it, finally allowing him to enjoy peace in his conscience that matches the true meaning of the covenant of grace. Chapter 6.